Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Performance Recipe Podcast. Next up, we have Dr. Jose Antonio, a world expert and professor in sports nutrition and exercise science, as well as the CEO of the International Society of Sports Nutrition, the ISSN. Today's conversation is all about protein. Hello, Jose Antonio. Thank you so much for joining me on the Performance Recipe Podcast. It's an absolute privilege to have you on. I know everything pretty much about you in terms of like what sort of research you go into, your podcast as well, but I'll leave the introduction all up to you. So if you'd like to introduce yourself, that'll be a great start. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, first, Rich, thanks for having me on. I appreciate, your interest in the subject. Let me give you a little bit of my background. I've been around doing this stuff for quite a long time. So, when I first went to university, this is actually back in the 1980s, there was really no one was really studying sports nutrition. In fact, it wasn't really a field of study. And exercise physiology or exercise science really wasn't around. I mean, there were a few programs here and there, but, you know, back then, if you had an interest in that field, you probably studied biology. So as an undergraduate student, I actually was a biology major. And during this time, I got my bachelor's degree at the American University in Washington, D.C. And all during that time, my interest was still exercise physiology. And once I got my bachelor's degree, I found a program at Kent State University. It's in Ohio. I'm not sure. Your audience is primarily, I guess, in the U.K. And I don't know if they know where states are in the U.S. They all probably look the same to everyone there, but Ohio is sort of located in the Midwest, or it's really closer to the Northeast Corridor in the United States. And I did a master's degree there in exercise physiology with a gentleman named Peter Lemon, who was really one of the first to look at protein intakes, primarily in endurance athletes. And he came up with the idea that people who do endurance training probably need more protein than people who don't. And so, again, this is back in the 1980s. And that really furthered my interest in studying it. Now, what's interesting is that even by the late 1980s, there really wasn't anyone doing sports nutrition research. I mean, they would kind of say they did it, but in a way, it was kind of the black sheep of the academic family. People didn't want to say, hey, I want to study nutrition, or I want to study, you know, supplements. It was more like, hey, I want to study exercise, and then maybe I'll throw in something nutritionally related. So when I started my PhD, this was at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. I didn't do anything in sports nutrition. My PhD, my dissertation topic was actually in skeletal muscle hypertrophy and hyperplasia. So people ask, well, why did you do that and not sports nutrition? And the reason is people thought sports nutrition was a bullshit category. They're like, eh, there's nothing there. It's all fake. Nothing works. And so you couldn't really study it anywhere. So my second love in science was muscle physiology. So I got a PhD in that field. I did a postdoctoral research fellowship in metabolism. And then I figured, okay, now that I have a PhD, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. And that's what I tell students all the time. Get the degree, do the fun stuff after you get the degree. So after that, I started looking more into studying supplements and sports nutrition. Now, this is what's interesting. Even by, God, the mid to late 1990s, most academicians, and when I say most academicians, most people in the field of, and I'll use the general term, sports science, they still thought sports supplements and sports nutrition was kind of a stupid area. They're like, yeah, no one really studies that stuff. It's silly, and the stuff is fake, and none of it works. And this is even after the discovery of creatine, the initial studies on creatine by Roger Harris and Haltman and a group over in the UK and Scandinavia. They discovered, you know, creatine helping When you supplemented with it, it helped increase skeletal muscle creatine, phosphocreatine. It increased skeletal muscle, lean body mass, strength, et cetera, et cetera. So even during the 1990s, people were not sure about this sports nutrition stuff. So what happened, and I'm compressing history into like a few minutes, and that's what's kind of interesting that I lived through this. Me and probably 10 other guys and girls, I mean, there's hardly any of us who love this topic. We decided, you know what? All of these academic organizations don't seem to think sports nutrition and sports supplements are worth a damn. They all have a negative view of it. So we decided back in the early 2000s, specifically 2003, why don't we create our own academic nonprofit, our own academic society that focuses just on sports nutrition? And that's where the International Society of Sports Nutrition was born, or ISSN. And since, think about this, since the year 2000, I don't know what the data is like in the UK, but if you go before the year 2000 in the United States, you would be hard pressed to find any college course on sports nutrition, and certainly nothing on supplements. After the year 2000, now it's been 24 years, almost every major university in the United States has a sports nutrition course, and PhD programs now are looking for people who want to study sports nutrition. So literally in the span of just two decades, it went from, that's a stupid field, to, oh my God, I want to study sports nutrition because it's such a cool field. So for really the last two decades, I focus almost all my work on sports nutrition, sports supplements particularly. And in fact, I think the ISSN was critical in promoting the fact that supplements, and sports nutrition as a whole is a legitimate field of study. So you might say that's sort of a long-winded way of showing how we got to where we are in 2024, with the ISSN playing a big part of that. I'm currently the CEO of the ISSN. And also, you know, I always tell people sort of my day job is I'm a full-time professor at a small private school in South Florida. It's called Nova Southeastern University. And again, I teach exercise science courses, sports nutrition courses, and I'm active in doing research in the field of sports nutrition and sports supplements. So it's kind of cool that, you know, a lot of students now, my undergrad students and also grad students, they don't realize that 20 plus years ago, you would be laughed at if you wanted to study this stuff. Now everybody thinks it's cool. So it went from being the black sheep of the family to like the cool kid on the block. So that's kind of where we are now in 2024.
Very cool. Yeah. So I heard Oskar Jurgendrop having a similar sort of story where he was talking about, you obviously know Oskar Jurgendrop is like here.
Yes.
So he used to be the head of Birmingham University for, I think he's the youngest ever professor. Even now he holds the record for youngest ever professor at Birmingham University. And he could barely find funding for research in carbohydrate and exercise and metabolism. And well, now look where he is. Birmingham's up there. Loughborough, you've got Liverpool, John Moores, all leading the way in the top 10 universities for sports science just here in the UK alone. So you've obviously paved a way for supplementation, especially because people like to look at supplementation as, is it real food? Is it not real food? And I heard Dr. Graham Close. I'm not sure if you know who that is.
Yeah, I know the name. I don't think I've met him, but I know the name.
Okay, so Dr. Graham Close was saying supplementation. Let's say he was in control of nutrition for England rugby, and he was down in South America in Argentina, and they got to a hotel, and there was literally bugs in the food. And he goes, what do people expect these rugby players to consume? Do they want them to go and have these whole foods and now full of bugs, or they're going to go and have to supplement? So that's just one way where supplements can be more beneficial than whole foods that people tend to forget about. So yeah, like honestly, what a privilege to have you. So many questions. Some of the questions I'm going to ask first are a little bit generic, and then we're going to go into a bit more specific, including supplementation, which I think
okay. Is
going to be quite fun. So what are the primary functions of protein in the human body?
Oh, that's a biology 101 question.
Yeah.
I mean, within the context of the human body, I mean, protein is, if you remove water and fat from the body, your body's basically protein. It's in your blood cells. It's in your enzymes. It's in skeletal muscle. I mean, you have different kinds of proteins everywhere. It's neurotransmitters. It's basically your entire body. So in our field, we don't typically look at it in terms of, you know, what components in the body is protein made of. I think most people think of it in terms of dietary protein, but everything in your body is made of protein. I mean, skin is made of protein. I mean, the most abundant protein in your body is collagen. So it's everywhere. I mean, without protein, there's no body. I mean, it's basically, well, depending how fat you are, you're basically water, number one, and then protein and fat. Of course, some people are more fat than protein, but that's because they eat too much. But that's another topic of conversation.
Yeah, protein is essentially, I don't know who said it, but they said protein is everything that you have been, everything that you will be, and everything that you are, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much.
So, hello?
I'm here.
Oh, there you go. Sorry, broke up for a second then. So protein is essentially everything you have been, everything you will be, everything that you are. Every single cell in your body functions through protein, right? So,
pretty much, yeah.
So would you say protein is essential in terms of a macronutrient for general health and well-being?
Well, yeah, well, protein is essential. Fatty acids are essential. I mean, the essential nutrients would be your fatty acids, vitamins and minerals, and then your amino acids. So, yeah, I mean, I think nowadays you don't really see protein deficiencies, not really in, you know, Western nations. But it's absolutely critical. It's absolutely critical.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I have quite a few clients who underconsume proteins, and they're getting in, it's shocking, 20, maybe 40 grams of protein when they first start off with me. And I just think I can have that in a single sandwich. And people really do underestimate their protein intake. I have clients who say to me, give me a 7-day food diary or even a 24-hour food recall. And it'll be fasting, first of all. So they've not had any dinner, not had any breakfast, probably fasted for about 14, 15 hours. Then they go and have cookies and stuff like that. And then they say to me, when I start giving them the more protein, higher protein intake, they say, there's just too much food. I'm too full. I'm going to get fat. So yeah, I know you've spoken on a podcast before, but is it possible to actually gain actual fat from pure protein? Obviously, it's not advisable to have pure protein, but protein is essentially, and people say that obviously protein can break down and it's glucogenic. Now, that's just an inefficient fuel source, isn't it? So can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, yeah, I'll rephrase the question. I mean, people have asked me, is it possible to get fatter if I overfeed on protein? And my answer is, well, yeah, it's possible, but it's highly improbable. And the reason I say it's highly improbable is because of the protein overfeeding studies that I did, going back to, I think the first published one was 2014. It's just, if you, and what's his name? Dr. Bill Campbell, he actually repeated some of this stuff. He's at University of South Florida. When you look at the data, eating a lot of protein, and here's the tricky part. So let's say you go over 2.2 grams per kilo, maybe as high as 3, maybe as high as 4 grams per kilo, which is a lot of protein. Two things happen. One, to eat that much protein, it means you're eating less of something else. Because you only have so much space in your gut for food, so here you are eating protein, which probably means you're eating less carbs and fat. Now, the other thing is when you eat that much protein, in a way, it almost kills your appetite. The subjects in my study, they didn't really complain about it. Their observation was, I wasn't hungry a lot. Food just wasn't fun because, let's face it, food is one of life's great pleasures. You want to enjoy your meal. You don't just want to eat to eat. So they would mention that, and also they would mention that because of the high thermic effect of protein, that they were always hot and always sweating. So if the goal, I always tell people, if your goal, and this is a strange goal, but I don't know, maybe someone has this goal. If your goal is to get as fat as possible, let's pretend someone's like, yeah, I want to get as fat as possible. Eating protein ain't the way to do it. The way to get as fat as possible is certainly you got to overfeed on calories, but the calories from carbs and fat are going to make you fat versus protein alone. And carbs and fat, well, what's that? Well, that's donuts. That's carbs and fat. Cake, cookies, carbs and fat. I mean, in essence, it describes a lot of junk, to be honest. But is it possible? Yeah. Is it highly improbable? Yes. I mean, it's just not a good way to put on body fat.
Yeah. So whenever I'm looking for a body recomp, especially when I've got someone who's extremely untrained, well, never trained, so untrained. And the moment I increase their protein intake to 1.6 to 2.4 grams per kilogram or 2.4 grams times their body weight, and even just doing 2 to 3 resistance style training sessions per week, the composition changes are absolutely mind blowing. You couldn't tell that they were the same person 3 months later. It's just, even on the same calories as what they were on previously, I've had people on, females specifically, because they especially, like women in their 40s and 50s, they come to me and they say, like, I've been going to Slimming World for the past 10 years of my life, and they look at food as a point system. And then I actually tell them to eat more food, but the macronutrient count where the protein is significantly higher than they've ever had before, and like getting the fiber in. And they're like, I'm eating more calories, but doesn't it more calories make me fatter? And the thing is, I don't know what your opinion on this is, but from a coaching perspective, what I've seen is people think they're eating less calories, but actually they're not at all by the end of the week once you've accumulated all the calories, because they're getting so hungry that they end up running over to the kitchen cupboards or to the fridges, and they're eating more without realizing that the calorie consumption has skyrocketed. So even though you're having more day-to-day set meals with protein in, you actually end up eating less by the end of the week in terms of calories, which drops off the body fat.
Right. I think the part that confuses a lot of individuals is the, you know, in general, it's true. If I eat more calories, I'll probably put on body fat. I'm like, that's generally true. Most people who do overeat, and there's a lot of people in the United States that overeat because we've got a 70% overweight and obesity rate, so clearly people are eating too much, but they're not eating protein. They're overeating on usually carbohydrate-based foods. Why? Because it tastes good, too. It's easy to find, easy to get. The part that a lot of people don't understand is that carbs, fat, and protein, when you ingest it, your body treats them differently, especially protein. And when you consume protein, you can't store excess protein. People, and that confuses a lot of people, because if you consume too much carbs, you can store it as fat. If you consume too much fat, you can store it as fat. You don't store protein. People are like, well, muscle's protein, enzymes are protein, part of the lipid bilayer, you know, your cell membrane is protein. I'm like, yes, but your body doesn't store it. So your body's like, what do I do with this protein? Well, typically, you use it for repair of muscle tissue, repair of organs, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens if you have enough protein for those processes? Well, you probably end up oxidizing or using it as fuel. And you can even say the same thing for alcohol. Can't store alcohol. So what happens when you consume alcohol? Well, your body has to use it as fuel. So when you eat a meal, people say, hey, alcohol makes you fat. You know, if you drink too much beer or whatever, well, technically if you're consuming alcohol with a meal, your body has to get rid of that alcohol. So it has to oxidize it as fuel because it can't store it. So what does it do with the rest of the calories? Well, if it's in excess of what you need, it's typically stored as fat. So that's the difference with protein. And I threw the alcohol in there too, because people are like, well, you know, I've seen skinny alcoholics and fat alcoholics. Well, protein, like alcohol, cannot be stored. So you have to oxidize whatever excess there is. And that's why, you know, I've known a lot of bodybuilders who are consuming easily 300 grams or more protein per day. And I actually know endurance athletes that are consuming well over 200 grams. And obviously they tend to be smaller, but 200 grams of protein for a small endurance athlete is a lot of protein. And they're not fat, and they're not getting fat. In fact, if anything, and you observe this, they seem to lean out quite a bit. So it's just strange how people view all calories, you know, protein calories, fat calories, and carb calories as being as treated the same when you ingest it. And your body doesn't do that. It's not like a bank account where you put money in and interest grows. It's, in this case, you can think of it as if you put protein money into a bank, think of it as someone's always stealing that money, so it never grows. Whereas you put carbs and fat into a bank account, it just keeps growing interest and growing interest because no one's stealing it, you know. So I'm not sure that's a great analogy, but that's sort of what I just came up off the top of my head. So hope that helps.
Oh, absolutely. That's actually an analogy that gets used very often amongst the social media world, amongst PT specifically. And you have this massive debate between PTs and then you've got nutritionists. PTs are saying calories in, calories out. That's pretty much all that matters. And then you've got your nutritionist saying nutrients matter, focus on the nutrients, and then not all calories matter. So what you said, it was actually a textbook, which I've actually got here, Sports Nutrition by Oskar Jurgerdrup and Michael Gleason, where they talk about how, all calories are the same, but when it comes down to the digestion, how it's used in the body, that's different because calories are calories, like a millimeter is a millimeter, but yeah, how it's used is going to be different. So like, fat for your low intensity exercise, carbohydrates, high intensity exercise, glycogen storage. There's loads of different things being used. What you mentioned
about protein. If you look at, look at real world situations, and I don't eat this way. I don't know how people do, but there are people who eat purely carnivore diet. So they eat meat. Mm. Meat, meat, meat. Just more meat, more meat. And I'm thinking, wow, I'd be bored because I love carbs. I have never seen someone who's strictly follows a carnivore diet who's fat. In fact, everyone I've met who follows it is lean. Now people say, well, God, why are they lean? Well, one, they're not eating carbs and fat, which is the easiest way to get fat. Two, if you're on a carnivore diet, you, by definition, you've limited what you can choose to eat. I mean, think about it. Okay, carnivore diet. Okay, I like fish, but I ain't gonna eat that every day. I like steak. Maybe I'll eat that every day. What else? Pork, chicken, bison, snake, alligator. I'm thinking, I would be really bored after a while, but there are some people who can do it and they're all lean. I have yet to see a fat person who actually follows a carnivore diet strictly. And, again, there's nothing magical there. Protein has a high thermic effect. You're not eating much carbs and fat. So it's very difficult to get fat on that diet. Now, and this is interesting, the people who are on it, they'll say they feel better, they're leaner, et cetera, and that can be entirely true. But when you're working with performance athletes, particularly on the endurance side, for them to train hard, they got to get some carbohydrate in there. And it doesn't have to be high, but it's necessary for training. And also, depending on the distance you cover for an endurance event, it's good to have carbohydrates while you're, competing in an event. So, yeah, that's that.
Yeah. Yeah, like carbohydrates for endurance. Well, you probably know this answer. For endurance athlete, what we're looking at 1.6 grams per kilogram, roughly. And then trying to get your endurance side of things. I think I heard you on a podcast saying that your wife does some sort of endurance competing and she goes upwards of 3 grams per kilogram of carbohydrates for her high intensity exercise session, her longer, more intense runs.
Yeah, she is up to 3 grams per kilo. Her carb intake is about 2 to 3 grams per kilo. Some people would consider that maybe on the low end. Yeah. Here's what's interesting, and I don't know how closely you follow what's said in the literature versus what people do. Now, if you read the literature on endurance training, oftentimes it's quoted that endurance athletes need 5 to 10 grams per kilo of carbs. And I know a lot of endurance athletes in Florida. Nobody eats that much carbs. Nobody. Imagine eating 10 grams per kilo of carbs. Think, do the math in your head. So if you weigh 50 kilos, 50 times 10, 500 grams of carbs. That's 2,000 calories just of carbs. What are you eating? Bagels, bread, pasta?
Yeah.
Now, this is where there's the art of sports nutrition and the science. So the science seems to suggest that you need a high-carb diet. Yet in practice, you don't see a lot of them are not. And part of it is part of the strategy of eating less than 5 grams per kilo of carbs is to keep body weight down because obviously body weight's an important issue for endurance athletes. And if you're just trying to run, let's say, 5 kilometers as fast as possible, levels of glycogen in skeletal muscle are not a limiting factor. In fact, if you just want to get carbohydrates, is just, for a 5K or 10K race, just consume it pre-race. So, you know, I always say look at the literature, whether it's protein, carbs, or fat, work with the athlete, and then sort of titrate each of these three things where it seems to work for that athlete, because everyone's going to be slightly different. Now, the one thing, you know, going back to protein, the one thing I will say is that if the goal is to lean you out, eating more protein seems to be the best way to do it. And I will tell people, let's say people just want to lose weight. They'll say, hey, could you help me lose weight? And I would say, how about this? Instead of counting calories, which is a pain in the ass, how about this? Just do one or two protein shakes a day. See how it affects your appetite and keep that up for the next 4 to 8 weeks and see what happens. And almost invariably, they lose body fat. So I think protein is the key to modifying body composition, more so than carbs and fat.
Definitely. One of the biggest hacks I can give out now is, from a nutrition perspective and just from a coaching perspective, is people who have a high protein breakfast, I'm talking 0.4 to 0.5 grams per kg of body weight for breakfast, makes them feel a hell of a lot fuller for the rest of the day. They actually end up moving a lot more. I'm pretty sure the muscle protein synthesis, you probably know the answer to this, muscle protein synthesis response in the morning is probably better than any other time of the day. Is that true?
Wait, repeat the question. Say that again.
So a higher protein intake in the morning, so you're talking breakfast, so 0.4 to 0.3 to 0.4 grams per kilogram or even more in protein intake first thing in the morning can get you moving more, keeps you satiated. But is it true that in the morning your muscle protein synthesis response is greater than if you were to ingest protein any other time of the day?
Well, actually, the quick answer to that is probably no. Total protein intake matters more. So if you need to get 200 grams, you're going to somehow divide it into, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and maybe a snack. Now, whether or not it's more important in the morning, looking at muscle protein synthesis, in a way is it's focusing on the wrong thing, because at the end of the day, muscle protein synthesis is just a snapshot in time. You're looking at, okay, what happens 1 or 2 hours after eating a meal? And I liken this, and I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but, you know, you watch baseball, and it's like the watching the first few pitches thrown in a game, and it's like, wow, that guy can throw. Well, does the first inning of pitching, does it reflect how they'll pitch in the 7th, 8th, or 9th inning? That's how I look at the data on muscle protein synthesis. And this is where it gets, you know, there's this weird focus on protein synthesis. Okay, what happens acutely? And I'll give you an example of whey protein versus soy. If you look at most of the data where they compare whey protein versus soy acutely, looking at muscle protein synthesis post-consumption, let's say after exercise, more often than not, it's whey protein does better. It's like, okay, well, that doesn't matter. You know why? Because humans don't just consume whey and don't just consume soy. They consume mixed meals throughout the day, and they eat multiple meals throughout the day. Okay, so what happens if you get those same people and you have them over the course of 8 to 12 weeks consume mixed meals? So maybe, you know, one group is consuming soy, another group is consuming whey, but also they might be consuming eggs and milk or whatever throughout the day. So over the course of weeks, what really matters? What matters is changes in body composition. So it's very difficult to see differences in body composition changes when you're comparing different kinds of protein over the course of weeks, primarily because we all eat mixed meals. I guess you could theoretically pay someone to live in a metabolic ward and say, okay, for the next 8 weeks, your only protein source is whey. Next 8 weeks, your only protein source is soy. And then we'll give you the same amount of carbs and fat, and let's see what happens. Well, I mean, that'd be one way to do it, but, you know, what idiot would volunteer for that study? I mean, it'd be a stupid study. Why? Because nobody eats that way. So I think there's this weird focus on muscle protein synthesis, these short-term acute effects. And it's gotten to the point, and I'll be quite honest, I almost start ignoring those studies now, because it's like, okay, well, we know what happens for the first few hours, but you know what? That actually doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is what happens after 4 weeks or 8 weeks. or 6 months. So now you're like, well, why do people do all these studies? Well, the God's honest truth is that's what they do. I mean, in science, you have to focus on something, and some groups focus just on the acute response to feeding, you know, whether it's muscle protein synthesis or whatnot. So I think in our field, there need to be more time course studies where instead of looking at what happens a few hours later, you need to look at what happens weeks later. Now, there are obviously drawbacks to that because people say, well, you can't control their diet, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, you're damn right. But that's what happens in the real world. You might have a personal, you might be a personal trainer and you have a client and your client would lie to you to please you. Everyone, you know, humans lie. It's just the way it is. However, at the end of the day, the more important data is what happens after weeks, not what happens after hours.
Cool. Well said. Yeah, that's where people get it wrong all the time. They'll read a piece of literature and they'll just go, right, this is going to work for every single person. And it's like, is it realistic though? Is it within the client's goals? Is it achievable for the client? And yeah, very often a client can't stay. Like I said, I've had a few female clients come to me in their 40s and 50s. Eating less than 40 grams of protein per day and telling them to go, you have to eat 1.6 grams per kilogram of their body weight in protein, just is not going to happen. And yes, they might lie to me. I always say to my clients, like, please be as transparent as possible, because sometimes they don't even realize themselves that they haven't consumed certain foods. And because people get busy, people have lives, people have stresses, and all these different things have an effect. But moving on from that now, because obviously you brought up muscle protein synthesis, and I know obviously we want to look at things from an acute perspective, but how does protein intake actually affect muscle growth and maintenance?
How does it affect muscle growth and maintenance? That's the question.
Yeah.
Well, I think in a general sense, we know that, well, your skeletal muscles are made of protein and you need amino acids are the building blocks of protein. So I'm still not sure what you're asking, because of course, you need protein for promoting skeletal muscle hypertrophy. But protein in and of itself isn't really the main thing that moves the needle. What moves the needle is actually resistance training. If the goal is to put on lean body mass or muscle mass, it's weight training or resistance training that does that. And protein sort of goes along for the ride. You just got to make sure you're not deficient in it. And it seems that once you hit about 1 gram per pound or 2.2 grams per kilo, that should be enough to elicit an increase in lean body mass. So people would ask, well, why would you eat more than that? Well, eating more than that might elicit a loss of fat mass. So it's really more of a resistance training question than a protein question. You can't just, for instance, you can't just eat protein and expect to gain lean body mass. In fact, if anything, and I've done those studies, nothing happens. You can eat a lot of protein and change nothing and nothing happens. But if you're resistance training, then clearly, that's what moves the needle. It's got to be weight training.
Awesome. Yeah, that's exactly what I was looking for. So, yeah, everyone thinks that just by having more protein, you just build more muscle. You have to be doing your resistance training. I was speaking to, you probably know him, Dr. Scott Forbes, and we were talking about muscle protein synthesis, and we were just talking about how people think that protein and creatine are just going to turn you into this lean machine, super muscular, walk into a gym skinny and out walking out like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's just not how it works. The protein and the creatine is just giving that extra 1%. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say, I don't know if you could put a number to it to give you that 1%. What if you were on a low protein diet, 0.8 grams per kilo? Yeah, you'd probably still gain some lean body mass to a point. But then after that, you'd have issues with just probably general recovery. So, if you get untrained people, and there's a lot of untrained people out there, and just have them lift weights, forget the diet stuff because diet's hard for most untrained people, they will put on lean body mass and then it'll plateau. So what do they have to do to change it? Well, they have to change the way they train and probably change the way they eat. Now, I can't really put a percentage to it. I mean, in general, it's the training stimulus that's more important, but you still need to couple a good diet with that. I think it's important. Just for, recovery purposes, because if you're doing resistance training, you still need to recover from it. And so that's where protein and even carbohydrates come into play.
Yeah, like people, yeah, so as a recommended intake, now if we were looking at different populations, let's say older populations versus athletic populations versus general populations, is there a difference then in the amount of protein that someone should be consuming as a general guideline? Because the World Health Organization obviously puts out 0.8 grams, but that's about 20 years out of date, isn't it?
The World Health. anyone who listens to WHO in terms of protein intake should have their head examined. That's the last place I would go to for nutrition advice. Last place. Hell, I'd ask my pet dog for advice before I go to WHO. For people who exercise, this is the advice I give. And it doesn't matter if it's they focus on if they're in a sport that's endurance, a sport that's power, or any sport in between, team sports. The goal, the baseline should be 1 gram per pound or 2.2 grams per kilo. That should be the baseline. And if they don't hit it, at least, you know, most people can at least get close to it. And if they exceed it, that's even better because if anything, it might improve their body composition. So I know if you look at the literature, you see people obsessing over, you know, anything more than 1.6 grams per kilo is a waste. And that's just really strange to me. It's as if, okay, so what happens if you go to 2 grams per kilo? What happens? What exactly is so detrimental that going from 1.6 to 2 is bad? And the answer is nothing. Nothing is bad. What if you go to 2.5 grams per kilo? Again, nothing's bad. In fact, nothing bad ever happens. If anything, body composition might improve. So this obsession with, and this is what's interesting, among sports scientists who work in nutrition, there's this weird obsession with limiting proteins. Most of them are like, well, once you hit 1.6 or 1.8, that's it, stop. And I'm thinking, you still have to eat. And if you're not eating protein, you're eating carbs and fat. And most athletes, let's face it, unless you're training for maybe a marathon or a triathlon, you're not going to have this tremendous need for eating more carbs and fat. You're better off eating protein because it helps you recover. So I'm not, you know, when people say, well, what's the upper limit? I'm like, you know what? I actually don't know. But I do know your baseline should be 1 gram per pound or 2.2 grams per kilo. Anything less than that is, you know, I call it, I tell people, don't be a minimalist. Don't do the least amount that gets you to where you want to go. Do everything that might even move the needle even a little bit. And so it's just weird that so many want to limit protein, but it's, you know, but they don't say the same thing with carbs and fat, which is really strange.
Definitely. So I had a conversation with someone down in Australia. He's a physiology, exercise and physiology researcher, specifically looking at things like sarcomerogenesis and whatnot, things that are like out of my scope of practice. But anyway, and he was asking, one of his main questions was back at me, and he was saying, is obviously in the research, when you're looking at hypertrophy, the general guideline is between 1.6 to 2 grams per kilogram, and they say there's no extra growth on that. But then I was listening to, Alan Aragon, and he was saying that they did case studies with professional bodybuilders, and they were having 2.5 to 2.7 grams per kilogram of their body weight. That's well over 300 grams. So just because the research says 1.6 to 2 grams per kilogram of their body weight, would you recommend maybe even having more because there might be an opportunity for extra growth there, maybe?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I always recommend more. In fact, I recommend 2.2 as the base. That's the bottom. Yeah. So that should be the minimum. And for bodybuilding, there's no downside to it. And I follow the philosophy I have is if it helps or has a neutral effect, just do it. I mean, there's no downside to going up to 3 grams per kilo. There's literally none. And that's why there's this weird, this I call it sort of an ideologic stance against a higher protein diet, which again makes no sense. It's got to be more of an emotional stance. So yeah, 2.5 to 3.0 grams per kilo. A lot of the bodybuilders that were in my studies, the male bodybuilders, they were well over 3 grams per kilo, and they were all crazy lean. So I think this, you know, limiting it to less than 2.2 grams per kilo is silly. And again, it's, you know, when people, you know, when you look at real-world examples, and you see bodybuilders or whatever, endurance athletes even go over 2.2 grams per kilo. Doing those kinds of studies are actually quite difficult. And that's why oftentimes you have to rely on what real world athletes do.
Yeah. Like I know some endurance athletes that do their marathons and Ironman challenges. They're hitting over 3 grams per kilogram of the body weight in protein easily. Endurance athletes do it a lot.
Endurance athletes they probably are eating anyone. And I've always argued that they may actually need more protein than bodybuilders because the amount of stress they put on their bodies far exceeds, I think, in my opinion, what bodybuilders do. Because particularly if you're a triathlete, you know, you got to run, bike, and swim. That's a hell of a lot of stress on your body.
Yeah. And you need to repair it. So more protein, more protein. For people don't realize, but besides the hypertrophy standpoint, like 40% of your bone metabolism is down to proteins too. And that's just one other aspect of many that requires a high amount of, protein. So we're talking about protein and obviously different thresholds and also getting in your carbohydrates. So I was wondering, what would you say are your best dietary sources of protein and how do plant-based animal-based proteins compare in terms of benefits and bioavailability?
Well, I think the single best food you could eat, you know, as far as a protein is fish. But it's not really because of the protein. It's because fish also has good fat. It has healthy fat. So I think fish is number one. I don't know what kind of, you know, if they have good sushi where you live, but the sushi and sashimi down in South Florida is excellent. So I think fish is number one. And then really any other animal-based protein, whether it's beef, pork, chicken, milk-based proteins, most of the data is showing in terms of quality protein, probably you'd say your milk-based proteins are the best. But again, these are short-term acute muscle protein synthetic studies looking at milk-based protein versus, you know, vegan proteins or vegetarian proteins. And sure, in the short run, it does work better. But again, you have to look at how people eat over the course of not just weeks or months, but years. People eat mixed meals. And, you know, unless someone is just eating or consuming just one type of vegan protein versus someone consuming one type of animal-based protein, you really have to look at the totality of what they're eating. But in general, you know, if someone were to say, when would it be advantageous to consume animal-based proteins versus vegan protein, it would be if you're on a lower protein diet. If you're on a lower protein diet, this is when quality matters. So let's say, and I define lower protein as 1.6 or less. That's when it matters. You should probably be consuming some of the higher quality animal-based proteins versus the vegan proteins. But once your protein intake exceeds, you know, 2 to 2.5 grams per kilo, it probably doesn't really matter where the source is.
Right. So, like you're talking about, obviously, like you've got the differences between animal-based proteins, plant-based proteins. Obviously, people talk about trying to match those amino acids because obviously you need the complementary proteins to get a full amino acid profile. Now, is that particularly important per meal, or is it just about just getting a range of different protein sources throughout the day and that will generally just be good enough?
I think in general, if you're getting multiple protein sources throughout the day, you'll be fine. I think you had alluded to matching different types of foods to get all the essential amino acids. Unless you're a pure vegan,
So just get the total protein intake because that's most important because obviously there was the barbecue study that came out and that showed muscle protein synthesis over 12 hours. And now why do you think that's happened now? Do you think that's because obviously they used milk protein, didn't they? And I think majority of it was obviously going to be casein and obviously casein is a slow release of amino acids. So do you think if you are going to have a shorter window to have a large bolus of protein, is it best to get it from a milk-based protein because of that? Or what's your general recommend?
Repeat that question. I was trying to follow. Are you talking about eating one meal, just one meal?
Yeah. Yeah, because obviously we're looking at total protein intake, and then obviously if you're going, if you're having large meals, and let's say you're traveling, you're a traveling athlete, or you're just someone that's on, you're a bodybuilder, if you want to call them athlete or not, that's up for debate, obviously. But like when it comes to the protein intake, let's say, yeah, you're traveling now, and you've got a shorter space of time to get your protein intake. Is it fine to have a larger bolus of protein, or is there a maximum amount that you could potentially have in a single meal without it being oxidized?
Yeah, well, under the situation you described, yeah, I would suggest get a, you know, let's say 100 grams of a high quality protein, and that would probably be milk based protein. So, and it's true, I guess, if you're traveling and you can't really get a good meal, it's like, okay, maybe I'll do 100 grams now, and then I'll eat whatever 9 hours later whenever I arrive, you know, wherever I'm going. So yeah, it makes sense in that case.
Okay, cool. So now, so that's, we've got athletes covered and most of the general population, but now do people become resistant to protein a bit later on in their age? Does that change up the numbers from your baseline of 2.2, or do they need to be higher? What's the differences there?
Yeah, this is interesting. As you get older, well, let's face it, as you get older, everything doesn't work as well. That's just the way it is. Now, there is data to show that older individuals don't respond to protein as well as younger individuals, which would suggest that they need to increase their intake, which, of course, I think the opposite happens. Certainly a lot of older people may not increase their intake. And actually, most people in general don't increase their intake. They probably end up eating, you know, less in general. So it's one of those things where, again, the thing that moves the needle the most for older individuals is, okay, first you got to regularly exercise, whatever it is, whether it's endurance training, resistance training, pick what you like. And to solve the issue of being a little bit more protein resistant with age, it's like, okay, you got to try to up your protein intake. And the easiest way, in my opinion, to do that is to consume a post-workout protein shake. Because by then you're kind of thirsty, maybe slightly hungry. It's an easy way to get extra protein in. And I know a lot of the products here, they all taste good, and you can get easily, you know, a 40-gram serving of protein in one ready to drink. And that to me is the best sort of solution to it, because it provides a solution it's a behavior that's easily repeatable, easily, you know, you can adhere to it. You know, hey, you're done working out, have a shake. You don't have to make any wholesale changes, you know, in your life. You don't have to, you know, cook anything special and whatnot, because the easier the behavior to repeat, the better, you know, the better the advice, you know. So that's what I would suggest. And, I know a lot of older athletes in South Florida, and, that's what I recommend. Keep it simple. And if you can't do simple, you ain't doing complicated. That's just the way it is.
Wait, that is a new hashtag right there. If you can't do simple, you can't do complicated. Love that. What a quote.
You can feel it.
I will. Don't worry. I reference you. Don't you worry. So talking about supplementation. So in the UK, we have some large influencers who I'm not going to name because I just don't think they deserve the limelight, to be honest with you. They talk about having supplementation. It's not real food. It's bad. It's poison. It's like whatever. So can we just discuss how whey protein, for example, casein, whether it be or protein supplements in terms of bars and drinks, you're saying they can be beneficial, right? So can we just clarify that?
Yeah, well, it's not just in the UK. It's in the United States. There's a weird sort of anti-supplement position in that. Let me backtrack. Okay, there's this idea of, you know, foods first, meaning fix up your diet and then do supplements. And okay, well, that sounds good. People repeat it a lot, but it's not supported by science. There is, in fact, if you look at supplement studies, let's look at the big ones, caffeine, creatine, beta-alanine, nitrates. If you look at those studies, you'd be hard pressed to find any study where they controlled for diet first. In fact, you could argue that if your diet is awful, creatine might actually work better for you because your diet is missing, you know, maybe you're not eating enough protein. So creatine actually might help you. Now, the idea that somehow supplements are bad or whatnot, it's, You know, if you consume, let's say, milk or orange juice, or if you consume any packaged good, anything that's boxed, and most people will consume, you know, some sort of packaged good unless all they do is buy meat, eggs, milk, and that's it. And fruits and vegetables. I mean, I guess there are people who do that, but there's still going to be some packaged foods you consume. Every packaged food is fortified with a vitamin or mineral or something. If you buy orange juice in the United States, it's fortified with calcium. That's a supplement. If you buy milk in the United States, it's fortified with vitamin D. Again, it's a supplement. I think people can confuse, well, if it's in a food, well, it's not a supplement anymore. No, it's still a supplement because orange juice does not have calcium. They've added it to it. So what's the difference between orange juice with calcium added versus consuming a calcium pill? There's no difference. And so people do consume supplements without realizing they're consuming supplements. And if, again, going back to the data, if you look at the data on supplements and particularly the ones that work, there's no evidence that you have to fix your diet or clean your diet or have a better diet before it works. Now, of course, you want to have a good diet. I mean, that goes without saying, but it's not a prerequisite. So the idea that, hey, food's first, supplement second. And my feeling is treat it all the same. They're all things you consume. Whatever helps you reach your goal, whether it's to lose fat, gain muscle, run faster, lift more weights, do it. Whether it's through supplements, whether it's through foods, whatever works, you do it. There's not a hierarchy of, that you got to fix your diet first before you take supplements. Now, obviously, I'm not recommending you not eat. Supplements are meant to supplement your diet. So everyone eats food. Let's just start with that. There aren't any humans out there that don't eat food and just consume supplements. Now, when you're looking at the more common supplements like whey protein or whatnot, people treat that differently than food. Well, wait a minute. Where does whey come from? It comes from milk. Milk is a food. So because, and this is where the word process gets kind of, people get all bent out of shape. It's true. Whey protein is processed food. It's processed because it's being derived from milk, but it's a damn good food. Now, you can call the food, you can call it supplement. Does it really matter what you call it? It's still a damn good food. And protein content of whey is higher than milk, has less fat, has less sugar. So in a way, you could argue, well, whey protein is actually better than milk, than whole milk or even skim milk. So to me, again, the bottom line is do what helps you reach your goal. If it's taking a supplement, do it. If it's changing your diet, do it. If it's changing both, do that too.
Definitely. So I mentioned Dr. Graham Close earlier from Liverpool John Moores. And he actually wrote a paper called Food First, But Not Always. And it was about how, sure, like you can have your whole foods, but doesn't mean that whole foods are going to be the best thing for you right then. So looking at protein, if you're on the move, trying to get your nitrates from beetroot juice, you're not going to be able to consume enough beetroot in order to get the benefits from beetroot juice. And same thing with creatine. You're going to have to be eating like a kilogram of salmon every day, and it's probably highly unlikely for most people because also it's expensive. Never mind trying to eat it all.
Yeah.
So yeah, 100%. So obviously I'm quite wary of time. So I just wanted to ask you as well. So are there any misconceptions about protein intake and its benefits? And also, for example, let's say kidney function, because obviously you've spoken about going over 3 grams per kilogram of your body weight in protein. People are going wild about how it can impact their kidneys. Is that true? Is that false?
It's bullshit. That's what it is. I mean, when we did those studies way back when, looking at protein intake and looking at kidney function, there's part of me that thought, wow, this is a real waste of time. Why am I doing this? Because I know it doesn't do anything. It doesn't harm your kidneys. And even all my friends in the exercise science world who did research, they're like, nothing will happen. I'm like, of course I know nothing will happen. Of course. We all know nothing will happen. But there are physicians out there. There are athletic trainers out there. There are dietitians out there who apparently think protein is, high protein diets are bad for your kidneys. So that's why I did those studies. And the longest one was we followed bodybuilders who are consuming about 3 grams per kilo over 2 years. And what happened to the kidneys? Nothing, which is not surprising. So even with that data, people still think protein is bad for your kidneys. And it doesn't make any sense. It's as if they treat high protein diets as if it's like the worst thing ever. And it's It's like, there's no evidence for that. And you see it on Instagram, you see it on X, you see it on Facebook. I'm like, where do these people get this information? I mean, they just make it up. So, you know, even after doing all the studies, people still believe the bullshit about protein being bad for your kidney. So what else can you do? I mean, what, do 10 more studies? They still won't believe it. So it's really kind of strange how that, even way back when I was in school, we're talking about 1980s and 90s when I was in grad school and undergrad, I heard the same thing. I heard the same thing then. I hear the same thing now. It's crazy.
Yeah. And even if people did try to over consume on protein, you're just not going to be able to. It's too satiating. You're way too full. Majority of people will find it an absolute chore to get anywhere near 3 grams per kilogram of their body weight in protein.
So yeah, good luck. In fact, that's a good point. In fact, I've had people ask, when I've given these talks, I've had people ask, well, what would happen if, like, what would happen if my dad consumed that much protein? And my answer is, you know what? Your dad will never consume that much protein. Your mom will never. Your sister will never. You know why? I'm just guessing because, you know, people ask me these random questions. I say, you know why? Because they don't work out hard enough. The only people who consume that much protein are people who work their ass off. These are endurance athletes. These are bodybuilders. These are strength power athletes. They work out hard. They work out consistently and they work out a lot. The average person, because let's face it, most people are sedentary. I don't know what it's like over in the UK, but in the United States, most people don't do anything. They sit on the rest. They are not going to go up to 3 grams per kilo of protein. They might go up to like 20 grams per kilo of carbs, but they're not doing 3 grams per kilo of protein. It's just not going to happen. So when people throw that straw man at me, it's like, hey, well, what happens if my, you know, diabetic sister consumes, you know, 3 grams per kilo? I'm like, she ain't gonna. It's not gonna happen. It's not gonna happen. People who work out a lot might do it. And even people who work out a lot, they know it's hard to do. Hitting, you know, 2.5 to 3 grams per kilo is a chore. I mean, you have to work at it. It's not like something you just wake up and it's like brushing your teeth and you hit that goal. You have to work at it.
Yeah, it's a chore. I've been training for 12 or 13 years of my life and trying to get over I tried my best to be 2.4 grams per kilogram. So I stay relatively lean all year round and people say like it's impossible. Like no, it's definitely possible. If you're eating enough protein, you won't be over consuming on all the carbohydrates. In fact, all the foods which look good, taste good, not satiating. We just want to eat more. And that's the biggest problem that we have at the moment as a society. It's just food is readily available. It's not satiating. Yeah. It looks really good. So because the carbs are bad for you, it's just, they just taste really good. So
And you know, you had mentioned, you know, people say it's hard to stay lean, you know, for a long time. It's, and I always say the solution is simple, but it doesn't mean it's easy to do. The solution is kind of simple, you know, eat a lot of protein, work out regularly. I'm like, well, that's kind of simple, but how people can't do it. Well, people can't do it because it's kind of hard to do. You got to be disciplined. And let's face it, most people don't have that kind of discipline. It's just, you know, you have to want it enough to be that disciplined. And most people just don't have it.
Yeah. If people can be consistent just for three months, literally just going 3 days per week for an hour and just doing that discipline for 3 months, if you cannot see your body composition changes, then you're definitely doing something wrong, obviously, but you will if you are sticking to the rules of what we've just discussed, we're alongside resistance training. And if that doesn't motivate you to continue, yeah, you're doomed. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
you're just not, shouldn't be lazy, basically. But yeah, I'm going to wrap up now. So first off, thank you so, so, so much. And hopefully this podcast does well in the future because I'm just trying to educate people as much as I possibly can. And there was no better person to speak to than yourself. I'm a massive fan of all your work and your podcast. And if anybody wants to basically just filter out the nonsense on social media, just look at your Instagram stories. They're brilliant. I'm laughing every day at your stories. So keep them up. But if you can just tell people where they can find you, that'll be great.
So on social media, you can find me on X or Twitter. Some people still call it Twitter at Jose Antonio PhD. And also Instagram, I have two accounts. I have the ISSN, International Society of Sports Nutrition account. That's the _ISSN. And then I have my personal account where I post paddling pictures, my podcast. That would be under SUPPHD. That is SUPPHD. And also for your friends in the UK, if you love sports nutrition, the ISSN conference is held every June. So next year it will be in Delray Beach. It's a beautiful beach. It's June 23 to 25, I believe. And the website is ISSN.net. That's ISSN.net. Again, it's at Delray Beach. And, you know, Rich, if you happen to come to Florida, you will love the beach. You may not even go back to the UK. I'll tell you that right now. So.
Oh, I'm born and bred in South Africa. I'm from the north coast of KwaZulu-Natal, where the middle of winter is 28 degrees. So I'll probably go there and never want to come back.
Oh, yeah. So just like Florida.
Exactly. Yeah, it's lovely. But yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you massively.
And Rich, once you post it, just send me a link and I'll share it.
Absolutely. You're an absolute legend. I cannot believe I had the opportunity to speak to you. And I wish you the best of luck with everything. And I'll come down to that ISSN event. I didn't realize that you guys did events here in the UK. So yeah, I'll definitely be popping down to that.
All right. Thanks, Rich.
Appreciate you. It. Take care. Yeah. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram at @rich_performance_nutritionist and feel free to drop me a message with your thoughts and feedback on this weekly chat so far.